Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record Program number 688, Darkness in the Vaults, being recorded on September 6th of the year 2009. As is so often the case, in fact, as is always the case, this program and your understanding of it will be greatly enhanced by using the website spitfirelist.com. It is the best website for information of this kind on Earth. Sadly, I wish there were better ones. But it contains, among other things, my entire life's work, 30 years' worth of work available for download for free. And there is copious documentation to supplement what you're going to be hearing in this broadcast. So please use that website. Again, I've worked very hard. I've now been able to get everything that I've ever done up on the web for download for free. So please take advantage of that. I've basically given my life in service of this effort. Obviously, I'm not dead, but I've sacrificed the bulk of what most people take for granted and done so for no pay. So please use what I have given you, if you would, because ultimately your fate and the fate of humanity depends on the successful dissemination of this information. Now, this broadcast is going to be dealing with the banking industry. That's obviously something that's come into a very dramatic view in recent months and years because of the financial collapse of 2008. People's finances, their money, of course, is something of paramount importance. And it may very well be that listeners, particularly newer listeners, are sort of puzzled, perhaps even a bit put off by the extent to which I talk about things having to do with World War II. Well, not only was the formation of the corporate state, which is what Mussolini called his fascist creation, is what he called fascism, was corporatism. Not only is that at the core of what's going on around the world, corporatism, that is, but more importantly, as explained in the introduction to the books section of on the SpitfireList.com website, the conflict of the Second World War itself was inextricably linked with the international cartel system. And that's something that needs to be understood. In this broadcast, we're going to be taking a look at the world's financial system, or at least some of the bigger banks in it. We're going to be taking a look, too, at their use of World War II loot, gold and other assets that were looted by the Axis powers during World War II, and which were then co-opted by the U.S. and the other victorious allies, but in conjunction with the, quote, defeated, unquote, Axis powers, Japan, Germany, and to a lesser extent Italy, who were cartel partners with whose major industrialists and financiers, I should say, were cartel partners with their counterparts in the West, in particular the United States. And we're going to be taking a look at some of the maneuvering around some of the gold that was placed in various banks around the world. Some of that gold came from the Third Reich. And much of it came from Operation Golden Lily, which was the systematic Japanese economic looting of occupied territories during World War II. As is the case with the Borman Capital Network, about which I speak so often and which I will touch on this evening or in this broadcast, the Japanese won World War II economically. They lost, of course, on the battlefield, but they won in the counting house, quite literally, and because of that, since, as Cicero noted, money is the sinew of war, they wound up winning. And with the Japanese and German ends of the international cartel system having won economically, although not militarily, ultimately they have prevailed and are prevailing politically as well. We're going to be taking a look in particular at the Union Bank of Switzerland, not the UBS exclusively, but the Union Bank of Switzerland. And we're going to be taking a look at some of the maneuvering around some of the Golden Lily loot that was deposited in its vaults. And some of the machinations that we're going to be examining are truly terrifying. And we're going to take a look at just how profoundly the residua of World War II, the tremendous wealth that was concentrated illegally as a result of war loot, has influenced post-war events and continues to influence post-war events. This is, in a sense, by way of illustrating how things that might seem to be long ago and far away, particularly to younger listeners, this is by way of illustrating to those listeners who find the frequent discussion of and references to the Second World War puzzling or perhaps even a bit off-putting. This is by way of underscoring the extent to which these events, seemingly long ago and far away, are the events which ultimately will determine, as they say in melodramas, your money and your life. We're going to begin by taking a look at an article from the SwissInfo.ch website. It's one of many stories, one of many articles about the Justice Department's attempts at getting the Union Bank of Switzerland to comply with U.S. law with regard to tax cheats, people who have a lot of money, U.S. interests who have a lot of money secretly stored in Swiss bank accounts, including UBS, and who, as a result, have been able to evade taxes. This article is from, it's dated July 1st of 2009. Again, this is a story we've spoken about before. It's headlined, U.S. demands UBS comply in tax evasion case. And by the way, most recently, the UBS has agreed to do so, at least in part. The United States is to continue its lawsuit against Switzerland's largest bank, the UBS, to try to force it to identify thousands of U.S. clients with confidential UBS accounts. The Justice Department said in a brief filed with a Miami court on Tuesday that it was pressing ahead with its case to reveal information about 52,000 Americans who were suspected of using the bank to hide nearly $15 billion in assets and thus evade U.S. taxes. It rejected arguments from UBS and the Swiss government that had tried to have the case dismissed. A court hearing is scheduled for July 13th. Despite media speculation about a possible settlement of the five-month-old case, the Justice Department said it was seeking to enforce tax compliance with the full weight of U.S. law. The United States has a strong national interest in making sure that all U.S. taxpayers comply with U.S. tax laws, including disclosing their offshore accounts and paying all the taxes they owe, the department said in the brief. And this is a case that's continuing. Again, at last, sort of notice, UBS has agreed to comply at least up to a point. By way of sort of looking at the fallout from this, and this perhaps could be interpreted as something of a return shot by the Swiss banking industry. This from the Bloomberg.com website, a Warren Giles article, Dateline September 2nd. Oldest Swiss bank tells clients to sell U.S. assets or leave. Weglin & Company, Switzerland's oldest bank, is telling wealthy clients to sell their U.S. assets or switch banks because of concerns new rules will saddle investors with tax obligations in the world's biggest economy. U.S. proposals to extend reporting requirements for banks whose clients buy American stocks and bonds, coupled with estate tax liabilities that may be inherited by the heirs of people who have such holdings, prompted that advice from the Saint-Gallen, Switzerland-based bank, said managing partner Conrad Humler. Quote, "We came to the conclusion that it's a threat to our clients," Humler, who is also president of the Swiss Private Bankers Association, said in an interview yesterday during a conference in Zurich. "It's also a threat to us as a bank, because as a custodian, we are an executor to the estate. We find this aspect discomforting, so we recommend selling all American securities whatsoever." Obviously, if all of the clients of these banks sell American securities, that isn't going to do much for the stock market, will it? No, and it won't do much for your 401k either, will it? Nope. One of the things that is so touchy about penetrating the veil of bank secrecy and the concept of offshore, which we have discussed so often with the brilliant Lucy Commissar, who graces our airwaves periodically, and that is that aside from the accounts held by private individuals, accounts which are used to hide wealth and thereby evade taxes, these banks, these financial institutions are repositories for a tremendous amount of looted wealth dating back to World War II, and that wealth is so massive that it in many ways could be described as a, if not the fundamental element, certainly one of the fundamental elements of the post-war financial system. And just how touchy the issue of war gold and war loot in Swiss banks and in other banks is something we're going to be taking a look at in this broadcast. Hence the title, Darkness in the Vaults. Now, I've spoken at length in the past about UBS and its involvement with the Bormann Organization. The Union Bank of Switzerland is a major Bormann Capital Network bank. So are some of the other major Swiss banks. We've spoken about that in the past. I'm going to touch on it briefly here, but mostly we are going to be taking a look at UBS and other institutions' role as repositories for the Golden Lily Gold, and beyond that, the Black Eagle Trust and related financial organs, which grew out of the Japanese war loot from World War II. Turning briefly to the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, one of Murrow's boys during World War II, who investigated the Bormann Capital Network, basically at the behest of Edward R. Murrow. Hermann Schmitz, the head of IG Farben, the Nazi chemical cartel, was talking to Martin Bormann about what would be needed to set up the Nazi flight capital program to secret German economic interests out of the country for the post-war German economic revival, something that was very effectively done. IG Farben's Hermann Schmitz talked to Martin Bormann, and it's described here by Paul Manning in Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. Hermann Schmitz explained to Martin Bormann that Swiss banking was quite special. Under a Swiss law passed in 1934 to keep Gestapo agents from locating the savings of German Jews, it is illegal for a Swiss bank to divulge information about any numbered account. Quote, "This also worked to our advantage," unquote, Schmitz told Bormann, again quoting, "It ensured our secrecy and kept the door closed to Allied fiscal investigators about our corporate holdings, manipulations, and movement of funds," unquote. He added that while there are 500 banks in Switzerland, there are only 8 basic categories of banks. The big three consists of the Credit Suisse Bank, the Union Bank of Switzerland, and the Swiss Bank Corporation, while the small big two are the People's Bank of Switzerland, or Swiss Volksbank, and the Bank Leu and Company Limited. But for the international requirements of such a one as Hermann Schmitz, the private bank in the seventh category is the bank of greatest usefulness. It issues no balance sheets and plays but a minor role in Swiss finance, but it is important to world finance and has stature and power way beyond its size. Well, again, just touching on the role of Swiss finance in the Bormann Capital Network, again, something that we've spoken about at great length. Before leaving directly the subject of the Bormann Capital Network, I want to emphasize a couple of points to listeners. The first is that that book is available for download for free on my website. Go to spitfirelist.com and you can download Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, as well as a number of other old anti-fascist books on very compact PDF files. I think it could be very accurately said that without having read that book and really grasping it, one's understanding of these programs and one's understanding of the other materials on the SpitfireList.com website will be imperfect at best. So please, at the risk of seeming a little overly didactic or self-righteous, please use that book. I place myself, frankly, at pretty great risk to get that up there. I knew what I was doing when I did it, but it would be comforting to me at least and useful to you if those efforts were not in vain. Okay? So please do use Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. Now, in the past, we have used on a number of different broadcasts a remarkable book, a consummately important book, that deals with the Asian end of World War II loot. This book is called Gold Warriors. It's authored by Sterling and Peggy Seagrave, published in hard and soft cover by Verso Books, and it is a really, really important and brilliant book. It's roughly 240 pages of text and about 100 pages of footnotes, bibliography, and index. And in addition, there are a couple of data CDs that come with the book when you purchase it. And I can't stress strongly enough that listeners should get a hold of this book and read it. I've, again, used Gold Warriors on a number of past broadcasts, and we're going to be taking a look at Gold Warriors for much of the duration of this program. Now, I've done a number of broadcasts dealing with the Golden Lily program. That was the Japanese economic looting of Asia that was set up explicitly under the royal family by Emperor Hirohito and his relatives. It was carried out faithfully and vigorously and very successfully by the Japanese armed forces and the secret services in particular, working in combination with the major Japanese organized crime syndicates, which to a considerable extent functioned as an arm of the Japanese government and the Japanese corporate structure. The amount of wealth that the Japanese successfully looted is enormous. The estimates of just the amount of gold, jewels, and other valuable materials that were secreted in underground vaults in the Philippines alone is something like over $100 billion worth of material just in the Philippines. And those are early 40s dollars, people. That is worth a whole lot more money today than it was back then. And there were Golden Lily sites in other Asian countries occupied by the Japanese in World War II. And much of the wealth was successfully returned to the Japanese home islands before the American naval campaign made such transport difficult, if not impossible. The economic victory in Asia during World War II was achieved by Japan, not the United States and the other allies, precisely because by controlling this consummate amount of wealth, and again, just the Philippine Golden Lily caches were over $100 billion worth of material, and that was in early 40s dollars, gave the Japanese tremendous leverage in the post-war years because of the fact that the United States, the dominant element in the international cartel system to which I alluded earlier, was gearing up for the Cold War. It was gearing up for the great anti-communist fight against the Soviet Union and other Marxist socialist countries. And the Japanese, like the Germans, were deemed to be essential elements in that anti-communist effort. So basically, the same elements were returned to power politically, economically, and militarily in Japan as in Germany, minus the uniforms and with a few of the more heinous figures having been executed. And basically, the reform, unquote, of Japan, like the denazification of Germany, were basically a farce. Behind the scenes, it was quite literally business as usual. And one of the reasons why this was the case was because through the looting programs executed very successfully by the Germans and the secreting abroad of the Bormann capital wealth, the Bormann Capital Network's wealth, and the successful looting under Golden Lily of Asia by the Japanese, it gave them economic dominance in the post-war world. Although this dominance has taken decades to manifest itself, it's beginning to. It's beginning to become pretty clear to people, I think, in some ways. There was a joke that made the rounds in the late 70s and early 80s. It said, boy, it's a good thing we didn't lose World War II. Otherwise, all of our officials would be named Schultz, Weinberger, and Kissinger, and everybody be driving Japanese and German cars. Well, of course, we're all glad that didn't happen, aren't we? That sort of makes the point. And what we're going to be looking at in this broadcast is the role of the war loot, and in particular, the Golden Lily gold, in the banks of the world, and UBS in particular. But we're going to be taking a look at other banks, and even though the Union Bank of Switzerland will be a major focal point, we're going to take a look at Citibank. And it's important to understand that one of the reasons why bank transparency just has not been able to be achieved is not just because of the tax cheats, and there are plenty of those, not just because of the very powerful organized crime syndicates which have secret bank accounts, and there are plenty of those, but also because within the vaults of the world's major banks, there lies a consummate, deadly secret. And that deadly secret is that not only was fascism not an aberration, but actually fascism prevailed in World War II, and the enormous looted wealth of the Second World War, successfully co-opted by the Japanese and Germans, really is the decisive factor in world economy, although not generally well recognized. One of the things that we're going to be looking at concerns a fellow named Severino Jesus Garcia de Santa Romana. He was a Philippine-born OSS agent in World War II. The Office of Strategic Services was America's World War II intelligence service and the predecessor to the CIA. He was present when General Lansdale successfully tortured General Yamashita's driver. General Yamashita, the Tiger of Malaya, was the Japanese general in charge of the last military resistance in the Philippines and also in charge of the final disposition of the Golden Lily caches in the Philippines. He was captured and tortured and under torture gave up some of the secrets of Golden Lily, and the American High Command was able to get a hold of many of these underground gold repositories and utilize them very effectively for a variety of purposes. We're going to talk about what happened when Santa Romana's heirs went to try to reclaim the some $50 billion that were in various accounts that he had. But first, we're going to take a look at part of the introduction of Gold Warriors by Peggy and Sterling Seagraves. There are a number of programs dealing with Golden Lily and this book, so listeners are heartily encouraged to use those broadcasts, or even more heartily encouraged to go out and buy the book. And by the way, I don't get anything out of this. I got no stake in this particular volume. In the prologue, the authors write, "Documents do show that between 1945 and 1947, very large quantities of gold and platinum were deposited in the world's biggest banks, including Union Bank Suisse and other Swiss banks, which became major repositories of the Black Eagle Trust." Parenthetically, the Black Eagle Trust was the synthesis of the Golden Lily gold with Third Reich gold that had been looted, melted down, and imprinted with the swastika and Black Eagle of the Reichsbank. And again, various funds, including the Black Eagle Trust, are discussed at length and in detail in a For the Record program called Funds and Games. Beginning again here, "Documents do show that between 1945 and 1947, very large quantities of gold and platinum were deposited in the world's biggest banks, including Union Bank Suisse and other Swiss banks, which became repositories of the Black Eagle Trust. Swiss banks played a pivotal role because Switzerland had remained neutral during the war and its banks had not been looted, damaged, or depleted. Documents signed by senior Swiss banking officials show that very large loans backed by this asset base were then extended to the British government, the Egyptian government, the Chinese nationalist regimes, and the Chinese nationalist regime and other governments struggling to recover from the war. What went wrong in the longer term is that the cloak of national security created a situation ripe for abuse. What protects national secrets also protects government officials and their collaborators in the private sector. In later chapters, we see numerous documented instances when these underground funds surfaced as huge bribes or were used to buy elections in Italy, Greece, Japan, and elsewhere. Beneficial trusts were set up on behalf of influential people throughout the world. Gold bearer certificates were given as inducements. In the hands of clever men, the possibilities were endless. Over a period of decades, some of the world's biggest banks became addicted to playing with the black gold in their vaults. Now, they will do whatever is necessary to keep that gold, even if it means defrauding account holders or their heirs, as happened with Holocaust gold in Swiss banks." And again, this book is the story not only of the Santa Romana accounts, which were used as a political slush fund to buy alliances during the Cold War. It was used to finance covert operations. But indeed, this book is a remarkable glimpse into the underground and very, very dark world of sub rosa finance, which really dominates much of the events, many of the events, and dominates much of what we deal with in our daily lives. And we're going to be taking a look at the attempts by Mr. Santa Romana's heirs to basically get a hold of some $50 billion in accounts that he had created around the world. And in particular, the Union Bank of Switzerland, again, a major Bormann Capital Network bank, was one of the major repositories for this wealth. One of the things to consider, too, is that in the context of the bailouts of financial institutions, it was said of many, including Citicorp, which we're going to be looking at here, that they were too big to fail. Well, they may be too big to fail, but one of the things that looms in the background of all of this, the attempts to get the Swiss banks to become more transparent so the U.S. can track down tax cheats and begin to heal the hemorrhaging on its balance books. But one of the things that looms large in the background is the fact that if there were really to be true global financial reform, some very, very dark secrets will come spilling out of those bank vaults in these institutions that are deemed too big to fail. So again, as one hears this, as you reflect on this, understand that these things are not something that were long ago and far away. And those of you who might be inclined to say, oh, there's Dave again talking about World War II. Basically, yes, we're talking about things that grew out of World War II. But we're talking about things that very dramatically and profoundly affect both halves of your very own rear ends. And we're nearing the end of this particular side, but we're going to begin by taking a look at the attempts by the heirs of, again, that remarkable OSS and CIA officer, Severino Jesus Garcia de Santa Romana, the man in charge of much of the Golden Lily loot that was utilized for political slush funds, covert operations, and so forth. We're going to take a look at the odyssey that his heirs experienced as they attempted to reclaim what was in his name. And we should note that these heirs were very, very poor indeed. And potentially some of the same sorts of entanglements that ultimately wound up frustrating Santa Romana's heirs could wind up affecting some of you as well, as the economic fallout continues to be felt around the world. They say that there is now a recovery underway. Well, let's hope so, although they're talking about a jobless recovery, which how can you have a jobless recovery? I know what they mean technically, which is that economic output is not receding. But a jobless recovery is kind of like living death. It's the ultimate oxymoron. If there are no jobs, damn it, there's no recovery. Turning now to Gold Warriors by Peggy and Sterling Seagrave, and we're going to continue with this on side two, we're going to take a look at the odyssey that was experienced by the heirs of Severino Santa Romana as they attempted to get a hold of some $50 billion of his wealth. And bear in mind, these were very, very, very poor people. None of them had any money at all. And the Seagraves write, when he died, Santi, that was the nickname for Santa Romana, when he died, Santi left to 14 heirs a fortune estimated by their attorneys to be worth over $50 billion. All their efforts to recover his assets from banks have been blocked, or, more often, evaded. And this is basically where we're going to wrap up this side. We're going to take a look at this strange and chilling odyssey, and we're going to take a look at what's happened to other people who attempted to rightfully implement and get a hold of wealth that was theirs. But when they crossed the darkness in the vaults, they found that things are not as they seem. Please use the website, people. It'll greatly enhance your understanding of these broadcasts. This concludes side one of, for the record, program number 688, Darkness in the Vaults. This has been recorded on September 6th of the year 2009. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.